Rest out, hoofah.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road. And, you know, anyway. Welcome. This is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And this is Drew.
Oh, God.
Hi, no. Everybody. I'm Drew, the sock puppet. And I'm here to say I won't be on the podcast today. Send your cards and letters to Drew, the sock puppet, at notinacreepyway.com.
Also, for the record, I have nothing to do with sock puppet. That's all Brother E. So I'm throwing you under the bus preemptively.
Beep. We are Drewless tonight. Due to an unforeseen camping thing, I think. I don't know. I was trying to read between the lines, but.
Oh, okay. I got nothing. I didn't pry. None
no,
of
no,
my business.
No, it's none of our business. So instead, we'll speculate.
<'Cause> that's rampant, what we do. Rampant rife speculation. Because, you know.
So luckily, this would just be a Brother J and E episode about Brother J's pick of the week. The movie J. Edgar, 2011, directed by Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, I've forgotten that, apparently.
Yeah. So, Brother J, you had seen this movie before?
I saw this movie in the theater opening weekend on a Saturday when I was visiting a friend.
And what did you think at the time?
I thought it was great. And I think it's a great movie.
Had your opinion changed at all or evolved since you watched it for this time?
No. I still like it very much. I think it's very, it's long.
It is 2 hours and 17 minutes.
It is 3,000 minutes long.
But actually, you know, so last week you heard us talk about Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, a movie that I think all of us appreciated some of. At least I can only speak for myself. I appreciated some of the parts when I was awake, but it did not inspire wakefulness. This movie, on the other hand, had every right to be just as boring, and yet it wasn't. I really like this movie.
Oh, well, I'm gratified to hear that, although yeah. I had nothing to do with the making of the movie, so...
No, but it's... Okay, so can we start with the elephant in the room? Probably the biggest thing to warn people about who watch this movie? Or do you think there is an elephant in the room? Do you think this movie has anything to apologize for?
I don't, but... But
what would you guess?
I would say that we all bring our own baggage on these trips, so I can't speculate as to what other people may have or their feelings. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, let's see, either the cross-dressing or the strange aging of Clyde.
The old age makeup.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. Yeah. Everything else is historical. But the old age makeup took a while. Although appreciated toward the end, mm-hmm. It really was just Armie Hammer's makeup that looked bad.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Leonardo DiCaprio really didn't put a lot of makeup on him.
Oh, they did.
Well, no, in comparison, I mean, he didn't have to have the ball headed wig and the liver. I mean, he aged, his makeup wasn't as intricate, I don't think.
I think it was maybe more intricate.
Oh.
I think it was probably a little bit, well, it was definitely, it was accomplished better on Leo than it was on Armie Hammer. And by the way, this Armie Hammer guy, I think he's got a future.
I really dig him.
How can you not like Armie Hammer?
Well,
so. It makes me want to watch The Lone Ranger.
Oh, dear. What's the first Armie Hammer movie that you saw?
Probably The Social Network.
Yeah, that's what I remember, too. Because he played the Winklevi.
to me, I was trying to figure out why I found him so charming. And probably because he's good looking and he's got a charming smile. He is the Judge Reinhold of the 2000s. He's got the boyish good. I mean, he's more attractive than Judge Reinhold, but he's got the boyish good looks and charm.
Okay.
Because I loved him in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. as well.
Yeah. Hang on, I'm trying to see what else is in Mr. Hammer's IMDb.
And okay, there is every reason to not like him because he's tall and handsome and probably super wealthy even before he was an actor.
Yeah, oh, you think so?
Well, his great-grandfather or grandfather or uncle or something, let's see.
Was Armand Hammer?
His great-grandfather, Armand Hammer, the billionaire tycoon of Occidental Petroleum, who, by the way, was investigated by J. Edgar Hoover.
Okay. So
a bit of the lore says that that's why Armie Hammer took the part. It may have been something to do with the fact that he also was able to be directed by Clint Eastwood in a Leonardo DiCaprio film, guaranteed to make money.
And well, I think the Social Network did good, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
J. Edgar, let's see. One moment. I'm consulting El Machino. Budget, $35 million. Gross, cumulative worldwide gross, $84
million. Okay, so it did all right.
U.S. gross, not very good. $37 million, so barely eked past its budget
and
in the U.S.
It was not nominated for any Oscars. I find that interesting.
Well, it was released. It was released in November.
Yeah, it was. This should have been an Oscar contender movie.
Mm-mm. But it didn't get any nominations.
Nope,
wow,
not a single one.
Maybe it was
up against lots of competition in 2011, 2012, I guess.
That surprises me, because it certainly the movie really it flows. It was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Oh, yeah. Several, I think.
Another 5 wins and 16 nominations. Sorry. IMDb. Sometimes right.
Yeah, exactly.
It won the AFI Film Awards Movie of the Year.
Sweet. Yeah, I thought it was really good. I was pretty impressed by it. And I wasn't sure what we were going to get. I thought it was going to be a little bit Tinker Tailor-y. But turns out, not so much.
Well, it was a little Tinker Tailor-y in as much as it moved back and forth in time.
That's true. Yes, it did move back and forth. Shall we go right on to the plot?
Sure. I mean, the plot's...
It's a biopic.
It's kind of... I kind of equate this to, like, J. Edgar Hoover is the equivalent to Forrest Gump.
Well,
because he seems to have put himself in all of the prominent noteworthy things of crime fighting during his tenure.
Well, that's kind of the point of this movie, is that he manufactured that himself.
Yes.
Like he is, his persona is definitely self-created. And I thought this was a fairly critical account of the man, you know? I mean, this was not an adoring look at J. Edgar Hoover, but it also wasn't super demonizing either. I mean, this was a complex cat.
It did. This movie did double duty because it showed you that he was crazy batshit off the rails at times. But it also shows you that he was a true believer. He drank the Kool-Aid, mixed the Kool-Aid, and gave the Kool-Aid out. So he really believed in what he was doing. He really had the faith and courage of his convictions to follow through. Now, whether or not he was in the right, that's an entirely another...
That's a murky area, which I thought, actually, Clint Eastwood did a really good job with. Or maybe there's something to be said for Clint Eastwood's directing style. He and DiCaprio got into arguments during this movie because Eastwood's shooting style is you play it as the script says, and then you move on. Like, it's not a Kubrick thing where you take 27 different takes one way, and then another 27 another way, and then give me a goofy take, and then 3 hours later, you're still doing the same scene. Are you nodding off?
No, I was going to try and make an empty chair joke.
Well, yeah, see, that's the thing, is that Clint Eastwood comes with his own baggage, yet I think he's a really good director.
Oh, yeah.
He does. You don't see a lot of him in the movie, and maybe that's what you see. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the product is what shines.
Yeah, and it does shine.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, you talked before about time, and it's told in an interesting device in that the movie opens with an older J. Edgar Hoover, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who has a writer come into his office because he is dictating his memoirs. And so the rest of the movie takes place kind of in flashback. And you keep going back and forward to, you know, to the writing process, but then back to when all these stories were pertinent. And Hoover had a very complicated history.
Well, he had quite the awakening. You know, he was born at a time where things were really undergoing a second revolution, if you will. And he grew up in a very, you know, he grew up around Quakers, and it was a very seemingly from the movie. Now, mind you, I haven't done any research into the actual real life Mr. Hoover, seemingly where he was geographically and socioeconomically, he was in kind of a strange, depressed little hole, and he had a strange family life, but he had been raised to cling to these values, and they were very important values, and even though he may not have understood them at the time, they colored and flavored his world from that point forward. And once he got a hold of something, he didn't let go. He was like a little pit bull that way. And up until his death, his files were sought after by everyone, which, you know, I remember hearing about that before this movie ever. I'd never seen this movie, so I believe that, at least in strong rumors, if not the truth.
Well, again, with Hoover, who knows what the truth is?
Yeah.
Because he had his own truth, but like Robert Evans, it's probably not the truth. It's probably just his story. And then there's Clint Eastwood's story. And then there's, although, let me just make sure we get the credit of the writer. The writer was Dustin Lance Black. And he actually has, it's funny, as a screenwriter, he didn't really, he expected there to be more ad-libbing and stuff too. He also wrote Milk.
Oh.
And When We Rise.
Milk's a very good movie.
Yeah. So.
Sean Penn, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I remember Milk being very good. You know, not a very uplifting movie, but.
Yeah. J. Edgar has a different kind of ending to it. Although it's not entirely an uplifting story, although I guess you can look at it from one particular angle that we'll look at a little bit later. But so let's just start out in the beginning. So we have a young J. Edgar Hoover in 1919, so just post-World War I, but well before World War II.
Right before the Great Depression.
Yes, and he is working for A. Mitchell Palmer, who's the Attorney General. So he's working for the Justice Department. And Palmer's house was bombed in an assassination attempt by some radicals. Because there's lots of like radical like labor groups, socialist/communist groups, who were doing, you know, radical stuff, like anarchists, things like that. There are lots of bombings and assassination attempts during this time.
Apparently, there was a coordinated bombing that evening that took out senators and judges alike.
Yes. So we see Hoover as eager to help out and also very critical of the way the police are handling the crime scene. Because Hoover is particular about forensics.
Well, there wasn't any handling of the crime scene.
Well, exactly, yeah. We, you know, again, maybe it's just a good storytelling device, but it gives you an idea that, okay, so he is a guy who is, I mean, forensics isn't even a thing at this point, pretty much. So he is on the cutting edge of this field.
Well, again, he is Forrest Gump because there's no forensics and then he envisions it and it happens.
Yes.
You know, so that happens throughout this movie where seemingly, at least at his telling, you know, he creates these forensics and these standards and these methods and rules.
And this whole agency.
Yes.
I mean, the Bureau of Investigation didn't exist as we know it as the FBI. They couldn't carry guns, you know, and it wasn't federal. If there were any federal laws, they certainly weren't something along this order, like violent crime. So some could say that he was instrumental in building the whole thing. Actually, he was, obviously. There's no denying he was instrumental in building the FBI.
Yeah, there's a big fucking building named after him.
Yeah, as well there should be. Mm. We see his home life is weird. He's got an absent father.
Well, his father's ill.
Oh, that's true. I'm sorry. His father, yeah, because his father ends up getting Alzheimer's or something, right?
Yeah, he's dementia or God knows what.
His mom, though, is Judi Dench.
Yeah, she was nice. It's nice to see her.
It is nice to see her in a different role than we're used to. Although it's interesting because she also reminded me a lot of the mother in The Manchurian Candidate.
I can see that.
She is building her son into something particular.
She's grooming him indeed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I love the little touches, like the fact that she asks him if he's been smoking, and he's like, he denies it in a way that you, like, wait, hold on. She wanted him to start smoking.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. So she has a vision of what her son should be.
Yeah. She was really trying to do some social engineering on him.
Oh, yeah. So he is already a strange figure because of this relationship with his mom. And we meet his soon-to-be, like, lifelong secretary, Helen Gandy, played by Naomi Watts. And yeah. I don't know about you, but I thought it was an interesting casting choice.
I thought it was a great choice. She was so, her performance was so understated, but I suspect not unlike probably how she was, how the real life Miss Gandy was.
Sure, but an Australian, a beautiful Australian actress? So I don't know. But it was great. Yeah, she did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
And she had to wear a whole bunch of age makeup too. So everybody aged in this movie. These three main characters. We'll get to the third in a moment here. But we have maybe Edgar Hoover was something of a proto-nerd. He claims to have developed the Library of Congress's
card catalog system.
Yeah, which I don't know if that's true or not, but
again, Forrest Gump.
A little bit. So that makes him sort of a nerd, and he's awkward around women, but evidenced by his trying to marry Miss Gandy after the first date.
Well, not even after the first date, the beginning of the first date.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the thing. It's funny because Miss Gandy says, no, I prefer not to be married because I have a career. That's wild. And, you know, so theoretically, she just got the right to vote by the time she becomes his secretary.
Yeah.
And yet she's going to be a career woman, which I don't know about her history, but it appears that was the case. Nobody in this movie gets married.
Well, I think the implication is that there was really never any time for family life.
Certainly not for Edgar, because he was driven, and the fact that he didn't have a family life or interests that allowed him to have a family life, maybe it gave him more time to do stuff like this. Frankly,
well, it made him reactive. He was able to be anywhere at any time.
Exactly. And he could devote hours and hours and hours to it. I mean, if he had wanted to be a guitarist, he could have been the Jimi Hendrix of the 30s.
He's the worst kind of boss because he sets the example for everybody else, and then nobody else can live up to that standard if they have a family.
Oh, exactly. Yes.
So.
Yep. And also awkward, so you can never really have a conversation with him, probably.
Yeah, he was, the mannerisms and, again, in the movie, I have no idea how accurate they were, but in the movie, boy, he had this strange germophobia, which they never went into, but they kept displaying.
And you kind of wonder if that was an artist choice by DiCaprio. But then Eastwood wouldn't let him have many artist choices.
I was going to say, if Eastwood was as strict, I doubt it. I bet that was part of the lore. You know, but he stuttered. And of course, he was a daffodil. So,
yeah, we get that scene where Daffy. It is not acceptable for him to be gay.
I'd rather have a dead son than a daffodil. Yes.
Also, okay, so he's really passionate about getting rid of radicals in whatever way he can. He's very Machiavellian in that way. Which
to the point where they deported an American citizen.
Does that ring a bell? Like, as if it could happen today? They just sort of find a loophole, a law, and if you could, you know, it's probably going to work, so it'll work. It's the only tool we have, so we're going to try to use it. Very, very sinister, that angle of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, again, it's the, do the ends justify the means? When you're dealing with things like deporting American citizens, it seems that that would not be the case, since America is based on those kind of things. Or not, depending on who you talk to. It was hard for me to watch this without thinking of current politics. Because obviously, James Comey was no Edgar Hoover.
Clearly not. Speaking of politics, and since you mentioned Comey, did you see the whole Gmail thing with him that Hillary responded to? Apparently, Comey was doing official government business using his Gmail account.
Yeah.
And Hillary Clinton had a 3-word tweet.
What was
but
that?
Her emails. Which is genius, so it made me chuckle. So,
well, it's funny. I'm not going to forgive Hillary anything. I don't want to forgive Comey anything.
Oh, no.
The history is what, you know, history will make of them what they deserve, I hope.
Yeah, there's enough blame to go around.
Bill Clinton seems to have missed a memo in what the Me Too movement means to the world. So everybody was using Governor Palin. There had lots of scrutiny because she was using personal emails for business.
Like a Yahoo account, right?
Yeah, and she also had, or Hotmail or something, yeah. And she also had two cell phones. One was for personal, one was for government. But that's not how it works when you're a chief executive. You know, it makes sense why there were people whose job it was to tape together ripped up notes that our current president could not figure out remember when we were talking before about the dead hand and about how Reagan had all these diary entries that you could read or that people have read and then kind of interpreted. Well, part of the reason they had the diary entries is because any kind of correspondence was covered under the law that you can't destroy presidential records. So
are you trying to retrofit that to somebody who doesn't hold the law with any regard?
Well, that's the problem. Is now there are no norms.
He believes himself. We've devolved into politics talk. He believes himself to be above the law.
Evidently.
He can pardon himself.
Well, depending on when you ask him. And I can't, okay, I have a hard time not looking at, and this is just purely, it's unfair of me to suggest that Rudy Giuliani, who had a great reputation, at least, I'm not a New Yorker, so I don't know what it was like to live under his reign, but he had a great reputation as a prosecutor of prosecuting the mafia in New York, insider trading and whatnot. And yet Rudy Giuliani is pretty much Nosferatu, a vampire, or Templeton the Mouse.
Well,
but anyway.
So J. Edgar.
Yeah, back to J. Edgar. Back to past American politics with maybe not squeaky clean figures. So, again, ends justify the means. So, when Attorney General Palmer loses his job after the Palmer raids and whatnot, we have the Justice Department's Bureau investigation. And that's where he's introduced to this candidate for a job, sort of, maybe, Clyde Tolson, played by Armie Hammer. And Clyde Tolson is a recent graduate from, I assume, a prestigious law school. And he's not even particularly interested in a government job, at least as anything but a stepping stone.
Yeah, he has no interest in the job long term. He says so on his application.
Yes. And during the interview, yeah. yet he is interested in
he's
the director.
He's fast-tracked.
Well, he's interested in the director, and the feeling is mutual. And it's actually, I thought it was a pretty touching portrayal. I mean, do you think it was over the top? Do you think, I just thought it was handled well.
Boyfriend Jesse and I had some discussion around this.
Yeah, please.
Because he said, he said at the finale of this movie that he said, God, this was a sad movie. And I said, well, what do you mean it was a sad movie? He said, well, they didn't live together and they weren't close. And I was like, well, wait a second. Just because the movie portrayed them as living in separate houses doesn't mean they weren't together and doesn't mean they weren't close.
They spent every lunch and dinner together, right?
Yeah. At the time. It wouldn't have been proper or politic for them to have been flagrantly together as a couple, and would have probably cost Hoover his job.
Oh, yeah.
That was the kind of notoriety. That's the kind of thing that Hoover would have put in a file and kept.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. No, that would have been something that Nixon would have liked to have on Hoover.
Yes.
That's where this Comey-Trump thing, again, springs to mind. So this Department of Justice report that just came out today, being fairly critical of James Comey when he was ex-FBI director, is a huge plus for the president, who is looking to smear Comey because Comey is part of this whole thing to, you know,
fake news.
Yeah, anyway. So, and it's all game playing. It's all on very high level game playing. Much like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, but with more action. Although, yeah, in Boyfriend Jesse's defense, I don't know why he needs defending, but if you look at this movie as a love story, it's a tragedy.
Yeah.
If you look at it as because I didn't look at it as a love story, although I appreciated that element of it, because I thought the performances were great. I thought Armie Hammer did a great job. I thought Leonardo DiCaprio did a great job of conveying feelings, even through some crazy ass makeup.
Well, it's his speech inflection and physical mannerisms.
Oh yeah, it's perfect.
I mean, he emoted quite effectively.
Sure. But also, we have this whole thing about, so this is, on one hand, I guess it could be a love story, although, like, I didn't really read it that way, and in which case it would be a tragedy, 100%.
Well, I think the love story was incidental, but it was indicative of Hoover's personality, that he was so tunnel-visioned and narrow-focused, laser-focused on his bureau, his baby, his inception, his creation, that...
Well, in a moment, he's more concerned about somebody else's baby.
He is pretty selfish because he wants people around him, but it's all about him.
Well, yeah, I didn't see his love story as much as that. This is a portrait of a very flawed person.
Yeah.
This is a person who did important things, both important good and important bad, but also he was very flawed. Like, he was very He was the cowardly guy that wanted the award for bravery.
Yeah.
You know, when he wanted all the glory to him. He wanted to take credit for every action within his department. Even when they went on organized crime and Machine Gun Kelly and all that stuff, it was pretty much spelled out in the movie, and again, a pretty clever way of storytelling, that he invented the FBI as a super organization, like a superhero kind of organization, and, you know, gave stories to radio plays and had, like, basically advertising about how what a great, G-Men, that whole thing.
Merch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And yeah. And he was irritated because the country was following these gangsters as some sort of American folk heroes. And he's like, no, we can have our own folk heroes. The good guys will be the folk heroes, even when we have to make up the stories.
Kardashians much?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he put himself in front of every camera he could in a flattering light. And it seemed in the case of, who is it, Purvis? Agent Purvis, who caught, the Mob Barker gang and Machine Gun Kelly or whatever. Yeah, he tried to bury him in the department because he was getting too big for his britches. So, again, he wanted all the glory to go to the organization as long as everybody knew he was the head of the organization. So, if they wanted him being out front in an arrest, he would go and make arrests. And that was the scene where he has to testify before Congress. I thought was really effective. When the congressman is saying, so, have you ever made an arrest?
Yeah.
So then we get the Lindbergh kidnapping, which is another piece of interesting history. I don't know. Are you very familiar with the Lindbergh kidnapping?
I'm not a crime junkie level of Lindbergh kidnapping. I know the basics.
Well, Lindbergh was an interesting character, and I'm not a Lindbergh expert or anything, except that he had some fairly racist views. And maybe after the kidnapping and murder of his child, spoiler, he got a little darker. Like, it seems like he and Henry Ford and stuff embraced a lot of, like, anti-Semitic views. And that's not a very noble thing, especially since, Lindbergh was a national hero. Again, maybe manufactured by the press as a national hero. But feet of clay and whatnot. So we show this whole Lindbergh thing where, at first, it's portrayed that Hoover does all these, like, amazing forensic things and finally is able to catch the bad guy who kidnapped and killed the Lindbergh baby, or sort of. But then, at the end of the movie, it's kind of retold through Tolson's view of, oh, yeah, you're saying all the facts, but all of the angles you're changing to suit your hero. Like hero turn, like your own star turn. So I thought that was really effectively done.
Yeah, it was a nice bow on top of everything.
Yeah.
You can lie to everybody, but you can't lie to me.
Exactly. Because
I was there and I know more than anybody else. Also, because we're sleeping together.
Yeah. Or at least lunching and dinnering together.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Again. Hors d'oeuvring.
Exactly. So we have the big old I love you, I hate you fight. And then we kind of go on to the decline of Hoover, where his chickens are coming. You know, he is getting too big for his britches. He is sure he has taken down Martin Luther King. Like, he is forcing Miss Gandhi to write a horrible letter to Martin Luther King about how... Well,
but earlier in the movie, you see just how strangely controlling and egotistical he is, where he helps and enlists Miss Gandhi to elevate his desk.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So yes, he wants to literally
look down on people. Yes. Oh, yeah.
But
well, and you see the thing where he has his confrontation with Bobby Kennedy,
which Jeffrey Donovan, Mr. Hoover. It was awesome. Well, I love Jeffrey Donovan and his RFK.
Over the top.
No, I thought it was perfect.
But it was great that he, you know, you see that Hoover doesn't like him and the feeling is mutual.
Yeah.
But also Hoover covets everything he has. He has his own fireplace built because he finds out that Bobby Kennedy has a fireplace.
Yeah.
You know, he delights, well, not delights, but he enjoys the ability to call him and tell him his brother has been killed. Like, that is some cold shit.
I think this is where Brother Drew would say, that's me.
That's you? I don't think that's you. No, you have delivered bad news, but I don't think you did it. I don't think you raced to the phone to be the one to drop the bomb on anybody.
No. But no, I just, Jeffrey Donovan's portrayal. I love Jeffrey Donovan. I have loved him. Burn Notice was a long running series, but before that, he was on Touching Evil.
With Helen Mirren or with the American version?
The American TV series that only had one season. Is awesome. Like with Vera Farmiga and Jeffrey Donovan. It was amazing. The show was amazing. I think it was too good for television and anyway. I gush about that show. I love it. I'm sorry that it didn't last.
Yeah, so we see the cracks, the chinks in his armor.
Ah, you can't use that term anymore.
No, you can't. Sorry.
Rest a hoopa.
So we already see he is tangling with all these important characters in history, but he meets his match in Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King is not going to be blackmailed. He's going to accept his Nobel Prize anyway.
Yeah.
And of course, Hoover's like, he has no shame, apparently. But...
Hello, kettle. It's the pot calling.
Yeah, but then we have, you know, he kind of meets his very similar nemesis in President Nixon, who seems to be just as petty as Hoover in very much the same ways.
Just as much of a conniving, backstabbing son of a bitch.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. In much the same way. And again, Quakers. Who knew?
Yeah. Well. I think Nixon probably recognized that he and Hoover shared many of the same qualities.
Game recognizes game.
That's exactly right. But Edgar knew. Edgar figured. I mean, there was no... He immediately told Miss Gandhi, like, you know, if anything happens to me, you have to get rid of the files.
Well, and that's, again, the part of the story it's interesting the way it's woven is that, so you see he's got this catalog system in the Library of Congress, then he wants to actually make fingerprints, like he wants a national archive of fingerprints. He wants to nationalize and not nationalize like in a political way, but like centralize all this data, which is all a great, I mean, you know, as far as law enforcement history goes, having the National Crime Information Center is a huge thing because otherwise agencies wouldn't ever share evidence with each other. I mean, you know, that's why serial killers could go from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and the other jurisdictions would never know about it because they didn't have similar computer systems, they have similar filing systems, they knew nothing.
Sure. And that it didn't exist and then... The technology didn't exist and the forensics didn't exist. And then he helped create some of it. Now, whether or not the idea originated with him, I suspect probably not.
Clearly not. Yeah. But he's the one that enlisted the guy with, you know, who put down his red stapler to go and match the pieces of lumber.
Yeah. But why was Hoover concerned that the files might fall in somebody else's hands?
Well, that's the thing. Once you have a centralized filing system, now you can collect all sorts of dirt. And, you know, you hide away the good stuff for use later.
Yeah, but if you're retiring, what do you care?
He was never retiring. He had dirt. He had dirt and it had value.
I think Nixon would have forced him out.
Well, he may have forced him out, but if you have the dirt, maybe you don't have... Like... I think that EPA Director Scott Pruitt must have some dirt on somebody, because why hasn't his ass been fired?
probably true.
So that's the thing is that, you know, he had power, he had political capital in these files.
Blackmail Eleanor Roosevelt.
Absolutely. And in a, he was going to blackmail her one way and then figured out, oh, hold on, there's something else entirely going on. We'll blackmail her in a different way. And
it's
so
two blackmails for one.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, and of course, that's, oh, it was a particularly fun scene when Hoover dies. The first thing that the president says is, go right now to his office, right now. Go, 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 get his files. This will be the only time we have. But of course, this has already been taken care of by Ms. Gandy.
Yes, she was very efficient.
And historically, all the secret files were destroyed, right? As far as we know.
Yeah. As far as we know, yeah. There's only little bits and pieces that got misfiled that ever were referenced. But yeah, nobody ever found any stuff, which is probably, everybody's probably better off. But.
Well, and that's the thing is that, you know, so these secret things, these blackmail items, certainly they exist in all sorts of different ways. I mean, but you know, he turned this arm of the Justice Department into the National Law Enforcement Agency that now has international implications and is like a huge crime fighting tool and has like many little offshoots that also has corresponding Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy agencies and then agencies we don't even know about.
Super Secret Squirrel.
Yeah, I thought this was an interesting story from like six different reasons. I thought it was well acted. I thought it was well shot. I thought it was well paced. I thought the pieces that they used, the historical pieces they used to tell the story were efficient, but also fascinating in their own right. Like I thought the Lindbergh baby stuff was fascinating. You know, I thought the Martin Luther King stuff and the Bobby Kennedy stuff, that was very interesting stuff.
Mr. Hoover.
I just did that for you.
I know. It was the alley-oop.
And then the Clyde Tolson stuff was a sweet humanizing element. Otherwise, this guy would just be the devil, right?
No, he was a monster. He was a monster, though. Sorry, I had to clear my throat. Nixon was a monster. There's no doubt about it.
Hoover. You said Nixon.
Well,
Nixon was also a monster, I think.
Sweaty bastard.
Turns out there are a lot of presidential monsters, but we're not going to keep going down that road.
I think it's a job requirement. Yeah, Hoover was a monster. He had some good traits and clearly some good qualities and did some good work, but a lot of it was rooted in evil plans and plots. I thought it was interesting whether or not the quote was actually his or not, but he, in the movie, J. Edgar says, he's a menace. He'll do anything to hold on to power. And that's his summation of Nixon. Well, dude.
Oh, yeah.
That's you. So you're upset with Nixon because he is now your competition. But there was a lot of little details in this movie that I appreciated. They had this strange scene with his sister, I guess. His younger sister when they're having dinner and his mother says, you know, it's solid weight.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Those are like those funny, like anachronistic things.
Yeah. That, and then, and how they go about explaining the cross dressing.
Well, and it's funny cause they didn't really, other than, you know, once his mom dies, he puts on his mom's dress. I don't think they really got into the cross-dressing. It was a thing, and it was a recently revealed thing in the zeitgeist, right?
Right. And the movie makes it appear that it was just out of a grieving man wanting to be close to his mother at the time. Because he was, again, according to the movie, he was devastated by his mother's death.
Oh, sure.
Which I can only imagine. I mean,
well, knock on wood. A boy's best friend is his mother. I just asked the Bates family.
I went immediately to Tom Lehrer, Oedipus Rex.
Oh, there's that, yes.
So now that's playing in my head right now.
Yeah, it'll be playing in your ears in just a second.
It seems that most of the songs that you hear these days on the radio, played by the disc jockeys, apart from rock and roll and other children's records, tend tend to be motion picture title songs. Apparently producers feel that we will not attend their movies unless we have the titles well drilled into our heads in advance. Of course, we don't go anyway, but at least this way they make back on the song some of what they've lost on the picture. But with the rise of the motion picture title song, we have such hits of the past few years as The Ten Commandments Mambo, Brothers Karamazov Cha-Cha, Incredible Shrinking Man, I Love You. I'm sure you're all familiar with these, but a few years ago, a motion picture version appeared of Sophocles' immortal tragedy, Oedipus Rex. This picture played only in the so-called art theaters, and it was not a financial success. And I maintain that the reason it was not a financial success you're way ahead of me was that it did not have a title tune which the people could hum and which would make them actually eager to attend to this particular flick. So, I've attempted to supply this, and here then is the prospective title song from Oedipus Rex. From the Bible to the popular song, there's one theme that we find right along. Of all ideals they hail as good, the most sublime is motherhood. There was a man, though, who it seems once carried this ideal to extremes. He loved his mother and she loved him, and yet his story is rather grim. There once lived a man named Oedipus Rex. You may have heard about his odd complex. His name appears in Freud's index, 'cause he loved his mother. His rivals used to say quite a bit that as a monarch he was most unfit, but still in all they had to admit that he loved his mother. Yes, he loved his mother like no other. His daughter was his sister and his son was his brother. One thing on which you can depend is he sure knew who a boy's best friend is. When he found what he had done, he tore his eyes out one by one. A tragic end to a loyal son who loved his mother. So be sweet and kind to mother, now and then have a chat. Buy her candy or some flowers or a brand new hat. But maybe you had better let it go at that. Or you may find yourself with a quite complex complex, and you may end up like Oedipus. I'd rather marry a duck-billed platypus than end up like old Oedipus Rex.
So there was a lot of little details.
Shirley Temple was hilarious.
Yeah. Well, Leah Thompson.
As the like the socialite girl that he went to the club with.
Yeah.
Is that who we're talking about? Yeah.
This movie had a huge cast.
Oh yeah. Well, again, Stephen Root, you know, from Office Space as the guy with the wood. It's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, Dermot Mulroney.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many familiar people in this.
Well, we have Ken Howard.
Kyle Eastwood was in it.
Jeffrey Donovan. We've got...
Oh, Leah Thompson was Lila Rogers, who I'm guessing is Ginger Rogers' sister.
Oh, yeah, maybe, yes.
And Edgar was too flustered to dance.
Yeah, he didn't dance.
He didn't like dancing. I don't like dancing, Mother. So there was you're right. There was some Batesism going on.
Oh, most definitely, yeah. Well, and I love, you know, it's funny. I love the mom because she's just so like she's not evil, but it's that kind of a character. She's just so consistent and offhanded.
Yeah,
in her, yeah.
She's not a warm person.
No. Not at all.
She has definitive ideas about Edgar and what he should do. And she comes down hard on him pretty bad, especially with the Lindbergh kidnapping.
Well, and when he,
she's, you know, the baby's, the limber baby's blood is on your hands, Edgar.
Well, and he is, you know, even when he kind of touts his own accomplishments, they're never quite enough for Mother.
Right.
And that's kind of a thing. That's probably a Shakespearean kind of level of trope.
Yes. True.
So anything else on J. Edgar?
It's an American love story.
Yeah, I'm curious what Brother Drew has to say. Brother Drew? Yes. What do you have to say about J. Edgar? We'll find out next week.
Will we?
I hope so. We'll ask him. We'll see if we got a chance to see it.
After I'm he listens he to have... this and boycotts us. No. You. Boycotts you, by the way.
No, there's no sock puppetry on the program anymore. Although I did have a vision that we would do all sock puppets at one point. Maybe even animated.
Who's paying for that?
We'd have to just do it piecemeal.
Like, it's not coming out of my salary. You're not paying me anything.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's definitely come out of your profits. Because I'm not paying you anything either. It's great.
Yeah, well, that's how that works.
Turns out the only person making money is Lipson. So, good for them, though.
I got to say, I've been using Overcast, I think, to listen, and it's been much better. It's been a much better experience.
Sweet.
To plug them a little, so.
Excellent, yeah. I use Downcast, but Overcast is good. I hate the Apple Podcast app.
I'm there. I finally have arrived.
So, yeah. So, anyway, so your verdict on J. Edgar?
This is an A movie. This is, it is... infinitely rewatchable. You will still enjoy it. There is lots and lots of layers of detail in this movie, which is why I have enjoyed rewatching it, because I see things I hadn't seen before. It's an intricate story. It's woven together very well. It does hop around in time back and forth, but not to its detriment. It has an amazing cast, and it's well directed, and it's a beautiful film. You know, it's got a lot of great shots and great sets.
You know who are good actors? Leonardo DiCaprio, Armie Hammer, and Naomi Watts.
Yeah, exactly.
All three of them are fantastic.
Well, Judy Dench is no slouch.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we'll give it to the dame.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what an odd role for her. I mean. She's great.
Yeah.
I'm glad she got it, but I would have, if you had stunt casted this, like, I can't imagine who you would have got.
Rosie O'Donnell.
Oh, dear Lord.
I don't know.
Whoopi Goldberg.
There you go.
Joy Behar.
Eddie Murphy. Yeah. Something like that. Lady
Roseanne.
Goldberg. Yeah.
Barbara Streisand.
Yeah, so I really liked it too. So I encourage you to go out and watch J. Edgar if you haven't seen it. I thought it was going to be a snooze fest, frankly, and I was wrong. It was great. So are we on to housekeeping?
I had face surgery on Monday after having knee surgery last Wednesday. So it's been a bit of a week and a half. I hate physical therapy, by the way. I know you're supposed to hate it, but I hate it.
Yeah.
But they pulled the cyst out of my face. I'm waiting for the biopsy on that. So that'll be interesting.
No physical therapy on the face?
Nope, just the knee.
To go yawn.
Although the plastic surgeon offered to Botox my forehead if I wanted. Because you're here, you know. I'm like, no, I'm good. He's like, are you sure? I'm like, no. But he did say, he says, wow, that the thing in my face was, he says, that was a lot bigger than I expected. So
did you get to see it?
Yeah, he showed it to me.
And yeah, it was as big as a...
It was bigger than a grape and smaller than a plum.
Well, that's good. Plums are pretty big for your face.
Well, grape is pretty big for my face.
So had you noticed it there for a very long time?
It's been there for probably a couple years. Okay. It was slowly getting bigger. He used that doctor voice that I always like... He's like, next time, just come in when you notice it. We could have taken care of it. It would have been super fast. No big deal. Like, yeah, but if I come in every time I find something, like, I don't need that. Like, I'm not buying you a boat, dude. But no, I'm really uncomfortable with the whole local anesthetic thing. The whole process of the, you know, the needles and injections and being awake while I can hear them cutting.
Oh, I want to always be awake. I never want to be put out.
Oh, I would have paid an extra $1,000 if they could have put me out.
Oh, see, I would have paid extra money to be awake for your knee surgery.
Why?
Because I don't want to be out. I'd rather know what's going on. Thank you very much. I'll be happy
Nope. Yeah. You know what? You want to molest me when I'm under? Do it. I don't care. Fine. Whatever. I don't want to remember it.
That so part just... of it never occurred to me.
I'm like, whatever. Like weird Abu Ghraib, you know, picture poses. I don't care. Whatever. I don't want to remember. So just do whatever you need to. But he said, because he had to cut a lot out. Sorry, Dad, if you're listening to this, if you've just passed out. So he had to kind of stitch my face back together. He said, well, I'm going to make this kind of tight. So you're going to notice your cheek's going to be tight for a while. Otherwise, you're going to have a divot where the hole was. So.
Sweet.
I'm like, oh, well, this is great. But luckily, it wasn't deep per se. It didn't go past the outer layer. So it didn't go into the muscle or anything. So no nerves, no anything bad. So
that's good.
But good God, I was like, ah. Oh.
So it's hopefully just like a sebaceous cyst?
Which wouldn't be the first one. I have one on the other side of my face years and years ago. Dr. Nathanson.
Oh, yeah. No, I got one taken on my back, and I'm sure there are probably other ones laying around.
Pickle fork.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was an unpleasant experience when I was a kid, so I don't remember that being high on the list. I do remember... going to the Apple store and buying a Mac game and having the guy recoil at my stitches. So, no, I mean, other than that, it's just physical therapy. I get my stitches on my knee out tomorrow. Yay!
Sweet.
So I'm happy about that. It's the little things, you know, because now I'm able to shower again, and that's glorious. You don't realize those things are so precious until you can't do them.
Exactly, yeah. Excellent. Well... I'm glad everything worked out, knock on wood, well.
My knee surgery went better than my face surgery as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Except for the fucking physical therapy.
I thought you said it was no big deal.
The physical therapy? Well, it wasn't a big deal until I went to physical therapy this Monday, and they're like, oh no, you need to be doing this and this and this and this. It gave me this list of stuff, and he evaluated me. But by Monday, I was walking without a cane or crutches, which is pretty good, without a limp. And he said, well, 70% of the exercises you clearly don't need, but these other 30% you need to concentrate on because you're faking it. You're using your other muscles to compensate.
Ah.
So I was like, ah, crap. So he gave me all these exercises, and... I'm trying to do them, and they're grueling, and I hate them. So, and I was just, like, sitting on the floor. I'm like, I couldn't do this before my surgery.
Yeah, his point, I think.
Yeah, so, like, yeah. I'm, like, weird contortion moves, and, like, wrap my leg and yank it with a sheet. And I was like, these are crazy masochistic things.
Huh. Yank it with a sheet. That's,
Yeah, that's going to be my band name.
Your first album title.
Yeah. Yank It With a Sheet by the Downies or something. I don't know. But the Downey Twins. Did you see the link on Facebook I sent you about the Shining sequel?
Yes. Yes, where Ewan McGregor plays Annie Torrance. Yeah,
that'll be interesting.
I have Dr. Sleep. And I intend to, I was going to reread The Shining and then read Dr. Sleep, but I have yet to do either of those things. But I haven't, you know, I've never read It. I've only seen the original movie, and I have the remake, the first part of the, you know, the It remake, but I think I'm going to hold off until the second part's available.
They made it into two movies?
Yeah, because the of course the book is, you know, like 1800 pages or something, and it deals with these kids, like flashing back between them being adults and kids. And the way they split up the movies is the first movie only has to deal with the kids. The second movie would be when they all grow up.
I see.
So.
Yeah. I'm not a Stephen King fan, so.
Oh, I am. I love Stephen King.
Yeah, I know. I know. I remember Christine.
Mm-hmm. Christine does not hold up as a movie, but it was still a fun book.
The Langoliers.
Oh, The Langoliers never
worked. Cousin Belky. Ugh.
Yes.
Yeah, Bronson Pinchot. I mean, yeah, The Langoliers and what, The Stand, and
What's next week's movie?
Sunset Boulevard?
Sunset Boulevard. Awesome.
Is that available?
I'm surprised you don't own it on Blu-ray.
They don't. I don't doubt they even make it on Blu-ray.
Wow, we got an interesting
set of movies.
Yeah.
I know, it was odd.
It was odd. Yeah, our brother Drew has set us up for Tropic Thunder and then Into the Wild, Batman Begins, Michael Clayton, The Crying Game.
Well, I imagine Michael Clayton and The Crying Game were probably mine.
You think? Maybe, yeah.
You know, L.A. Confidential's on Netflix.
Oh, I love L.A. Confidential.
Wait. Oh, now Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy's on Netflix, you bastards.
Didn't The Saint 2017? What is that?
That was the new one. The TV movie one, I think. That's the Brother Drew. I don't think I did that.
Yeah.
Or if I did, I did it at the behest of...
Shane? We have to watch Shane?
What?
I mean, what? We get to watch Shane?
Why?
I don't know. It's on the list.
Okay.
Salt. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.